All right, this is Sarah Peterson with the Southern Oral History Program interviewing Robin Kirk, the director of the Duke Human Rights Center. It is Monday, June 23rd, 2014. It is around 2:30 in the afternoon, and we are in a conference room at the Franklin Humanities Institute at Duke University. We're going to be talking about Robin's life work as a writer and human rights activist, with an emphasis on the role of remembering history, story sharing, and reconciliation after conflict in her life's work. So, first off, thank you, Robin, for sharing your story with us.
Thanks for doing this.
So, why don't we start with you telling us a little bit about yourself, where you come from.
I was born in Illinois, so I'm a Chicago girl, mm-hmm. And went to University of Chicago, mm-hmm. and then left and spent a number of years in and out of Latin America doing reporting first from the country of Peru in the 1980s. Mm-hmm. And then in the 1990s, I joined Human Rights Watch as a researcher and began covering Peru and then Colombia for them. And mm-hmm. I spent 12 years with Human Rights Watch as a human rights advocate. Mm-hmm. I found that especially after September 11th, I felt like it was important to think about doing human rights at home and not mm-hmm. just somewhere else. So with colleagues here, I lived in Durham because for family reasons, and I had never really paid much attention to Durham and to human rights issues in the United States because I was very focused on Latin America. But 9/11 kind of was a jolt for a number of reasons. And so with colleagues here at Duke, people who I had met, I decided to change directions and helped found the Duke Human Rights Center here mm. and also the Human Rights Archive, which are mm. both now thriving enterprises where the point is to connect human rights abroad to human rights at home and mm-hmm. see human rights around us as well. And so out of that has mm. have come incredible projects like the Pauli Murray Project, mm. New classes, hopefully a certificate in human rights here at Duke for students. But I think the broader idea is to make sure that we are enabling students to not only think critically about human rights and about their place in history and their place in a location like Durham, but also feel empowered to think about how to work for change.
Hmm. Wow, and I think it's very interesting that you're so invested in developing a strong sense of human rights in students. So I guess I'm wondering, was there anyone for you when you were growing up who was a role model for you in developing this strong bend towards social justice, both internationally and locally?
I think for whatever reason, I always had a strong sense in my family of doing right. Not that my family were activists. My dad was a business person. My mom, for many years, was a stay-at-home mother and then went into business. But I always, I think, felt, for whatever reason, a strong sense of right or justice and right when things aren't right. And mm-hmm. even as a high school student and then as a college student, I felt like it was important to do not just study about something and not just enjoy life, but also to try to do something when possible. And I always wanted to be a writer, and so mm-hmm. I always saw that as one way of framing a life and framing the world. And I was always struck by that E.B. White quote, which is something like, you know, I wake up every morning torn between the idea of enjoying the world and saving the world. And that has always been sort of part of my challenge, is to mm-hmm. be engaged and happy and appreciating things, but also be observant to how things can be better and how some people aren't as fortunate as I was, and that yeah. I have a responsibility to mm-hmm. make a difference. Mm.
And were there any experiences in particular that brought you to that understanding?
I think, well, as a writer, I think you are always really attuned to when things aren't going right for someone, and you maybe have a darker view of the world, so you are looking for the people who don't fit in or the people who aren't getting a fair shake. And so I think as a journalist in Peru, I got a big dose of that and where people, for no reason other than they were in the wrong place at the wrong time, would be caught up in this political violence that mm-hmm. changed their lives mm-hmm. and took away loved ones or left them injured. And it seemed like no one, you know, only a few people really cared. There's this saying in Peru, and you hear it often in Latin America, which is, in Spanish, it's por algo será, which means it must have been something. Mm-hmm. And that's what people who haven't been affected by violence think, that the people who were mm-hmm. victimized by violence, it must have been something. They must have done something wrong. Mm-hmm. They must have made themselves vulnerable. But the fact mm-hmm. is they didn't. And that sometimes political violence can hit, or violence in general, but political violence in particular, it doesn't necessarily target only the people who are involved, but it often targets mm-hmm. people who have nothing to do with it, or the family members mm-hmm. of someone who might have had something to do with it, but they don't deserve to be treated in the way that they're treated. So I got a real education in both my privilege as a white American, mm-hmm. But also the fact that somebody needed to do something. And mm-hmm. I think I saw my role very much as transitioning from a journalist to a human rights advocate, to using my writing and my skills, language skills, interest in proving history and whatever, to not just write about things, but to actually try to make that writing serve a purpose of changing the human rights situation for people who otherwise didn't have much of a chance.
Mm. Wow, and I definitely want to delve more into understanding deeper what you were experiencing in Peru, but I'd like to back up for a moment and just ask you a few questions about your experiences at University of Chicago mm-hmm. and how you first got interested in reporting.
Well, I came from, again, someone who always wanted to be a writer. Mm-hmm. So I had actually started college at this little Southern Illinois university called Blackburn. It's where my parents had met, and my family had been sort of in crisis when I graduated from high school, so I didn't end up doing anything about applying to college, nothing.
Wow.
And but this little school had always had space. So my mother dropped me off. And if I remember correctly, I was hungover. But it was not the most auspicious of starts to college. But I very quickly realized that it was not the place for me. But one of the great things that it gave me was a semester in Mexico, which I think I applied for because I basically wanted to get out of Southern Illinois. But that changed my life because I learned Spanish. It was a study abroad program unlike any study abroad program I've ever seen since, because basically what happened was our Spanish teacher flew down to Mexico City with us, taught us the first night, taught us how to drink tequila, and then left. Literally, left. So there we were. And no one was taking attendance, and no one cared whether we went to class or not. And so we didn't. And so we basically just traveled all the time and met people and moved in with people and had adventures. And one of my college classmates never came back. She withdrew from school, married a guy, and never returned. So it was quite a baptism by fire. Not exactly what I would recommend for a study abroad program now. Not one I'd want my daughter to go on. But I think that really, you know, from a relatively sheltered young woman to mm-hmm. someone who really felt like I wanted to see the world, that was a real education. And I think that also was the beginning of, you know, I had worked a lot in high school, and I had worked mainly in restaurants as a waitress, and most of the restaurants in Chicago were staffed by illegal immigrants from Mexico. Mm-hmm. So it was sort of the continuation of that education. Where did they come from? Why did they come from there? What was it like to be poor in Mexico? What was it like to not have education, to not have any hope for advancement? So I think that in some ways was the beginning of a consciousness about the fact that I had things that I didn't necessarily deserve, but that gave me a leg up over most people in the world, and that I had a positive responsibility to do something.
And did you kind of deal with that and wrestle with that through writing? And
I think so. I mean, I was, like most young people, I was pretty, you know, in some ways unaware of some aspects of that. So I didn't. I wrote kind of from a more denunciatory, you know, like this bad thing must be changed and stuff like that, without much understanding of the limits of humanitarianism and some of the limits of do-gooderism, and, you know, and the fact that I was, you know, replaying an old and very familiar role of the young idealistic person who goes elsewhere to do good works instead of doing good works, you know, around me. And I don't think that that's a bad thing. I think it's that we should do good works wherever we are, but we should also be aware of the limitations of good works. And that's something that I learned in, you know, my work as a journalist, but then in Human Rights Watch, is that as much good works as you can do, as much hope that you have, there are limits to the kind of impact that you can have. And also problems with the idea of being an American and privileged and middle class and all that kind of thing, problems of going abroad and doing good works, that it isn't such a simple, straightforward thing.
And do you feel like you had that consciousness as a college student?
No, not at all. No. I hope very few college students do, because I want college students to be hopeful. But I think life ends up teaching everybody a lesson, and I think that's necessary. It can't all be in the classroom. It can't all be from stuff that you read. You have to go out and experience things and see them for yourself. But college did give me, when I finally switched to the University of Chicago, which was a great thing for me, saw that the intellectual armature that helped really position myself and say, okay, I'm not the first person who's ever done this and who's ever thought about these things, and there's a whole history here, and there's all these complications. But just because there's a long history and complications and all that kind of stuff, it doesn't mean that you can't or that you shouldn't try to do it in a different way, and try to do it in a way that is more conscious and that is maybe more, takes into account the histories that, I think too often students of a certain type take that critical approach and make it into a reason not to be engaged, and I think that's the wrong lesson. I think it's a reason to be engaged in a more conscious way.
Interesting. And what was your transition like from going to Blackburn to University of Chicago? Was there anyone who helped bridge that transfer for you?
Not really. I was pretty much on my own for pretty early. So it was, I think I luckily realized in some inchoate way that I needed an intellectual environment that was really challenging. Mm-hmm. And I am lucky as hell that a lot of freshmen drop out of the University of Chicago. So they are always looking for transfer students. And it really was, because my GPA was not so great, and my high school record wasn't so great. But University of Chicago took a chance on me, and I'm grateful that they did, because it really showed me that you could be really thoughtful and really interested in ideas and really interested in writing. And I, going back to your question, I worked for the newspaper at Blackburn, and then I became the news editor at the University of Chicago magazine, and I really saw writing as kind of my way of engaging with the world. Though I did famously write, I was very interested in being correct as a journalist. So I was covering some of the crime, and there's a fair amount of crime on the south side of Chicago, and somebody had been killed with a knife, but the police hadn't said yet what the cause of death was. So I wrote some horrible paragraph of some sort that said something like, police believe that the person may have been killed with the knife that was found in their chest. Something like that.
No.
But they hadn't actually said that the knife was the cause of death. So I was trying to be very, very accurate, and was ribbed for that mercilessly for many, many weeks afterwards. You think maybe that was the cause of death, since it was maybe just possibly found in her chest?
So. Interesting. And I guess I'm also kind of wondering, coming from a feminist perspective, what did you think of feminism at the time? Was that something that was talked about a lot in UChicago?
I don't think it was. That's still the early 80s. It was kind of, I mean, it was still women's lib, believe it or not. And I, you know, to tell you the truth, I never felt that discriminated against as a woman, though I'm sure I was. But I never felt it. It never seemed super obvious to me. I think I was too embedded in the patriarchy, if you want to put it that way. So I never felt, but I never felt like I was not the kind of student that didn't speak up in class. I spoke up in class, and I didn't give a flying hoot what the men said. I mean, I was kind of, in some ways, weirdly oblivious. It would have served me to be a little bit more aware, I think, because I think it did affect me. But then it didn't stop me from you know, doing things that were, you know, probably really poorly thought out. But I never really had a consciousness of myself as female in a, as a disadvantaged or, you know, group. It was just, I was so self-absorbed, maybe in a bad way, you know, that it was just about me. I was like the center of the universe. So it was like, whatever I wanted to do, I could do. Like, I don't think I had health insurance until I was in my 30s. I never thought about it. I mean, I never thought about careers. I never thought about, like, who to network with. It never occurred to me. It was always about my, you know, I was a stereotypical writer. It's like, it was all about the writing. It was all about the writing. So it was like, I'm going to be a great writer, and I'm going to do it this way and do it that way. And, you know, to, unfortunately, probably limiting myself in some ways professionally, but the... But as a feminist, I don't think I ever... I was involved with causes, like apartheid in South Africa, what's going on in Central America, what was going on in Chile, what was going on in Peru. It's like causes that were pan... that were that were about human rights, but not specifically feminism or women's issues. So I think that came much later for me.
And were you just working in kind of news-style reporting as a style of writing, or were you doing creative writing as well?
No, I've always done everything I could. I mean, I've always been sort of across the board, but for money, it was mainly news reporting, kind of more in-depth news reporting, not so much. And I did do some amount of literary journalism, and Amy Willens, who's a wonderful writer, who wrote just an amazing... This book has actually inspired a lot of people my age and younger, a book called The Rainy Season, which was about Haiti. But this kind of really in-depth, really thoughtful coverage of, you know, a place that most Americans don't really know well. And that really inspired me. So I was, you know, trying to write in that style. But I was also doing daily journal, not daily journalism, but I was what they call a super stringer, which is somebody who does sort of in-depth pieces for a variety of U.S. magazines or newspapers or radio. I did worked in radio for a while. And so it was mainly just finding any place that would publish or take or pay for kind of more thoughtful news, as opposed to just, you know, this bomb just went off over here, or this person was just killed. It was just like, well, what's behind that? And I found myself going towards the human rights stories more and more, and not so much the, you know, general interest or adventure or travel or stuff like that. That didn't interest me at all.
Well, and kind of shifting from your work locally at the university, what was the transition like being in college and then going to Peru, reporting from a very international position?
You know, I think of myself now, thinking of myself back then, and what a just an incredible risk taker, and just, you know, kind of astonishingly clueless about all the things that, the bad things that could have happened, and that, but, you know, thank God, you know, in some ways, the youth wasted on the young. But I just was drinking it all in. I mean, I was ready to be a writer, and to me, it was like the old school of writing. It was like, you don't go to school to be a writer. You don't get an MFA. You don't. You have experiences, and that's all. I was all about drinking it in and having experiences and doing as much as I could in a, as most, you know, sort of heedless way as possible, and just drinking in life. So I, you know, traveled, I lived in, I had a partner at that point, so we traveled in Latin America together, and then came back, lived in San Francisco for a while, and then he eventually pursued a PhD in Peru, but when we came back together in the late 80s, where I did full-time sort of journalism, and were there for 3 years, kind of through the worst of the violence, and then towards the kind of the beginnings of a relatively more stable country. And at that point, he got a job offer here at Duke. It was 92. So we arrived here in 92. And at that point, the already the war had been winding down in Peru, so there wasn't so much work. And I was already thinking, well, what am I going to do now? I didn't want to do business journalism and, you know, work for the Associated Press or whatever. So that's when... I happened upon this job with Human Rights Watch, where they were looking for someone who knew about Peru, and it was like kismet. So I could, and I had already wanted to do writing that was much more political and much more focused on actually changing things, as opposed to just like having a magazine article that people read and they say, oh, well, how interesting, and, you know, into the recycling. I really wanted to do something much more focused on actually building movement on the basis of information. So, you know, human rights reports that actually changed things and actually moved policy and could put people in jail and could affect the way that a powerful country like the United States would treat a country like Peru or Colombia. So the Human Rights Watch transition was great for me.
And did you feel that the reporting that you were doing in Peru before was not moving policy?
No. I mean, reporting, it's very unusual for journalism. I mean, journalism as an aggregate can move policy, but like one person is just a, you know, drop in the ocean. And I mean, I think I did important pieces. I did important work, but it never, but it was lost in this great cacophony of other stuff going on, like what's going on in the 1980s. You know, you've got Central America, you've got, you know, Iran, you've got what's going on in the, you know, Israeli occupied territories in like Peru. Peru, it's this tiny little place. And the U.S. had some interest there in terms of the drug war, but it wasn't like a big motivator of U.S. policy. Not that it should have been, but it was just like, you know, and I did stuff for NGOs, like on refugees. I think I was the first person to write about the incredible refugee, in this particular case, internal refugees, which means people that don't cross a border but have to leave their homes because of violence. And I was the first person that really wrote about that for a NGO called the U.S. Committee for Refugees. And that was, like, satisfying. And then some guy from the U.N. came and he literally plagiarized my entire report. That was an amazing moment. It was like, you plagiarized my entire report and filed it with the United Nations. Great. Oh. So I guess that's an effect. My partner at that time, he'd written something on these kind of vigilante patrols in Peru that were forming in the north, and some people in the south, where a lot of the violence was, were taking this technique and creating these vigilante patrols to fight the Shining Path. And at some point, when I was working for Human Rights Watch, I'd gotten a bunch of secret documents from the government that I'd obtained through a FOIA, Freedom of Information Act request, and I was reading these State Department cables, and it was like, oh my God, they plagiarized his work. And it was just like, wow, when you see your work being plagiarized by, in this case, the State Department, I think it was Department of Defense, and then my stuff being plagiarized by the UN, it's like, you know, you have an impact, but it's so diffuse. You know, it's, and it, you don't ever see like policy change. And the thing about Human Rights Watch and the work I did there is I actually saw, you know, policy change and saw policy makers pay attention. And I would get phone calls from this guy who was the aide to Senator Patrick Leahy. He's a wonderful guy who was his foreign, Patrick Leahy's a senator from Vermont who's on the Foreign Appropriations Subcommittee in the Senate. And he and his aide just kind of knew everything. It was a real human rights advocate and proponent. And he would call me and he'd say, so Robin, you know, how much money should we put in the budget for the Attorney General's office in Colombia? And I'd say, I don't know. $6 million? And he'd say, okay, $6 million. So what do we spend it on? And I'd be like, let's see, what's that like? They need some cars, and they need some forensic kits, and they need travel money. And it's like, okay, okay, okay. But that's only like $500,000. You know, like, we have, you know, $5.5 million to spend. You have to tell me what we can spend it on. And it would be like, oh, okay, okay, you know, what are we going to spend it on? So it was, you know, that you really got the sense. I mean, not that it necessarily was as effective as that makes it seem, because it's still, there's a lot that happens in the middle of that, but you, at least you feel like your writing and your advocacy and your research is actually, you know, being put to some sort of practical use, whereas in journalism, it's like, sometimes you can hit big with a big story, you know, and maybe things change, but most of the time, it's, you know, you're the satisfaction you get out of it is, you know, well done, you know, well written, well published. Maybe some people commented on it. I mean, it's even worse now with the internet. It's like publishing something just goes off into this morass. So to have a real impact is really a privilege.
And while you were doing your work in Peru, I read that you were focusing a lot on women's leadership within mm-hmm. the Shining Path movement, and you actually wrote mm-hmm. a book about it. So I was wondering what drew you to that aspect of the story, and if that was satisfactory to you, or you know, did you feel that you were making a difference there, learning about these women's lives?
What attracted me to the phenomenon was that you have this insurgency, which is a Maoist insurgency. So in the mm-hmm. great scheme of communist thought, it's a particular kind of Marxism, which was elaborated by Chairman Mao in China. And the idea is that, put it kind of the most practically, is that you don't need this movement, big movement of lots and lots of people, you know, like you see in the Ukraine or you see in mm-hmm. Egypt, you know, great masses of people. Mm-hmm. You don't need that. What you need is this small vanguard of really committed revolutionaries who mm-hmm. follow a plan and then do whatever they need to do to create the contradictions in society that will lead to revolution. Mm-hmm. And if you're Maoist, you don't really care what those contradictions are. You're not as concerned about the impact of your campaign on people, on the great mm-hmm. masses of people, because your point for revolution is going to be, it's the end justifies the mm-hmm. means argument. So a classic Maoist insurgency is the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia. So it's like it's not relevant that you committed a genocide to create this sort of utopian peasant-run society. Mm-hmm. Those were necessary sacrifices that mm-hmm. you had to make as a vanguard party to create kind of utopia on Earth. And the Shining Path is very much of that type. Mm-hmm. So one thing that came out of a lot of the interviews I was doing was the fact that often people would talk about women being very much in positions of leadership in these incredibly brutal, bloody massacres and killings and executions. And one of the ones that really caused the most wasn't a massacre, it was a single killing, but it was of an incredibly important person, was this a young woman who was an African, Afro-Peruvian, who worked in one of the shanty towns called Villa El Salvador, Maria Elena Moyano. And she was this brilliant leader, feminist, left-wing, you know, really effective, charismatic, you know, up from nothing. Mm-hmm. And one day a Shining Path woman came up to her and dropped a bomb in her lap and ran off, and she was killed. Mm. It's like, how is it possible that a woman would come and kill a woman like that? And that just was beyond perplexing. It was really, I just could not understand how you could get to that place. And so that's the genesis of that reporting. Mm. And so I went and looked, and I started, you know, looking at some of the accounts of women who belonged to the Shining Path. Sure enough, it was true that women have real positions of leadership, although within the context of a patriarchal insurgency with the man at the top. But, you know, a number of members of his secretariat were women, powerful women. A lot of the icons of the movement were women. A lot of the field commanders were women. And it was just really hard for me to understand how a woman could do that. So to be a commander, you leave your family behind. Often you leave your kids behind. Mm. How could you make that sacrifice? How could you, you know, especially as someone at that point, you know, a little bit older, you know, that's a big deal to make those kind of sacrifices. And what I realized was the way that the Shining Path did that and the way they argued this to women was very effective, where women were essentially told through this Maoist rhetoric that your background, you know, your class status, your ethnic or racial status, your gender is totally irrelevant. Hmm. What matters is your commitment to the cause. Hmm. Are you willing to do whatever it takes to reach this utopian vision of the future? Hmm. And so you could, you know, Peru is a very racist, very macho society. So by belonging to the Shining Path, you jump over all of the discrimination against you based on your gender, all of the discrimination against you based on your race. Most of the Shining Path women had indigenous background. Not that they were themselves necessarily, they would consider themselves indigenous, but they're brown-skinned, a lot of them Quechua speaking. But they could just go right around that as members of the Shining Path and become, you know, really important commanders. So it was a different kind of feminism, in a way, that basically said, you know, you jettison that feminine part of you. It's not that it's not completely, it's not that it's relevant, it's not that it's completely irrelevant, but that it's not, the most important thing about you is your commitment to the revolution. And that was an amazing sort of thing when I kind of got to that part where I realized that that's what these women were doing. And I did a series of interviews in the prison in Peru at that time. Women, people in prison controlled their own cell blocks. So you could go and talk to the women of the Shining Path by getting their permission to go into the prison, mm-hmm. into their particular part of the prison. So I was able to arrange that. So I did some interviews inside the cell block, and after I came out, I was talking to a journalist friend of mine, and I said, I still don't... you know, I asked them questions like, what does it look like? You know, so you succeed, you win, you get what you want. So what does life look like? You know, is there daycare? I asked that question. Is there daycare in your Maoist utopia? But I was trying to make it concrete, you know.
Right.
Do you have a cook? You know, are you cooking for yourself? You know, do you have kids? Do they live with you? You know, or is it some sort of like Hunger Games, you know? What is going on here? You know, this is obviously very pre-Hunger Games, but like, what is this post, you know, society look like? Not a single one of them could answer me. Like, what, you know, specifically, what, how would their lives be different? So I was saying this to a journalist friend, and he said, Robin, you've got this all wrong. He said that they're not, it's not like they're doing this to get a graduate degree, you know, or they think, you know, if I save enough money, I'll be able to buy a house. This is religion. This is faith. So, you know, you can't really ask someone who is religious, like, what exactly does God look like? Because they don't really necessarily know. They haven't really given it that much thought. But the fact that God exists, yes. You know, they think so. But, you know, does he have five fingers? Is he a he? You know, does he have a tail? Is he a spirit? You know, they're not going to be able to tell you. And that's sort of was my final way of understanding this, was that it was really a religion. And once you bought into it, it's like any religion. Once you buy into the sort of the central tenets of faith, then everything makes sense. And for these women, everything made sense because they've made that decision to believe in this Maoist sort of interpretation of how things worked.
Mm. And how are we doing on time?
I should probably go in about 5 minutes.
Okay, well, let's wrap up the talking kind of about the Peru section, then we can continue with the more focusing on the Duke Human Rights Center and Polyamory Project next time. So do you feel that working so closely with them, with the Shining Path, really challenged your preconceived notions coming in as a privileged white American Westerner? And
Absolutely.
Your ideas of
Absolutely.
What constitutes democracy and what constitutes social movement, what constitutes
very much
human rights.
So. I mean, I'm still working out a lot of it. Barbara may have mentioned to you that I'm working on this young adult trilogy, and the whole thing is really based on the Shining Path. That's you can use that, but when I make $1 million, I will disavow it. But the whole thing is about that. I mean, this is, it sounds like, oh yeah, I really want to read a book about genocide, but it's about genocide. But I was trying to think of what I wanted to write after I finished another novel on Colombia that is for adults, but I really wanted to write something for younger people. And because I'm a huge fan of a lot of YA stuff, I don't know if you were a big YA reader, if you ever read The Book Thief.
Oh, The Book Thief. No, I have
not. You need to read it.
Okay.
It's changed my life.
Okay.
But not that I'm writing anything near the level of that book, but The Book Thief is essentially about the Holocaust, but from the perspective of this young German girl who lives in Germany at the time of World War II. So it's unlike any other book about the Holocaust you've ever read, but it is an incredible book.
Wow.
And it really allows readers... It's marketed as young adult. I don't necessarily agree with that category in general, but it's an amazing book about how people come to believe in genocide. And for me, as a human rights person, kind of switching hats here, the whole motor of genocide and the reason why the Shining Path could do what it did was that they believed that there was a greater purpose. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of the motive of genocide in general. Mm-hmm. The Nazis, the Khmer Rouge, the Serbs, whatever, the Hutus, it's all about, you know, yes, this is terrible, yes, this is awful, but we've got to do it. It's a dirty job. Someone's got to do it because the world will be better. If we get rid of those nasty Jews, if we get rid of those nasty Tutsis, the world will be better. Mm-hmm. So in the Shining Path case, you had this challenge to what we think of as a typical woman, because you had these women out there basically leaving their families behind, being involved in war, you know, killing people, massacring, and justifying it without any remorse whatsoever. What does that mean to be a female in that sort of environment? So that the YA book that I'm writing is about sort of a post-apocalyptic, I mean, that's sort of a convention, but a society that women are in charge of, but it immediately begins to challenge this idea that there's some sort of essential womanness, that women are more peaceful or women are more understanding or, you know, and it's like I'm really playing with the ideas of gender because it's, and not from a critical, I'm not meaning to criticize feminism because I'm a feminist. I believe in equality, all that kind of thing. I don't believe that women are necessarily more peaceful. I don't believe that women are necessarily more, I don't necessarily buy into that idea that if you had women-led societies that we'd all be better off. I think we need people-led societies. We need human-led societies that where these kinds of values are shared by lots of different people, gay, straight, female, male, mutant, or otherwise. We need, because we're all becoming mutants. That's the other thing. It's like the whole definition of what it is to be human, what it is to be someone's child, is completely changing. I mean, you can be a kid and, you know, be from a sperm donor and an egg donor and have had a surrogate and have two parents that are, you know, divorced. And, you know, it just, the complexities of what it means to be human, what it means to be a family, the kind of gene manipulations that we're involved in right now, and this is getting into sci-fi territory, but it is not, the fact is that a lot of this stuff is here with us. We just don't see it. So I think for me, The Shining Path was the beginning of a long journey that I'm still kind of on and trying to understand what it means to be care about making the world a better. You know, they care deeply about making the world a better place, and they care deeply about the fact that they had come from disadvantaged groups and that they were making. You know, they were rebalancing out the world, and that's kind of the flip side of my own activism. It's like, it's not so uncommon for people to believe so strongly in what they think is right that they will sacrifice others to do that. And that's obviously a really dangerous place for advocates to be saying, you know, we know what's right and we're going to make everyone else do what we think is right regardless of the, you know, of disagreement. So I think, you know, democracy is what it... Will Rogers say it's the worst system except for all the others, and there are real. It was just in fact when you at two we were talking. Patrick and I were talking to a Hungarian colleague who teaches in Budapest, and you know in Hungary right now they're on this whole new fascist swing. It's like the fascist party is one of the most popular parties in the country, and the most popular new theater, the most inventive new theater in Budapest is a fascist theater. And it's like, really, seriously, 2014, we're back to the way Hungary was in 1938? You know, but it's like, but it's within this democracy. So it's like you really have to probe and question, and I think The Shining Path really showed me that. It's like you have to really think about your own preconceptions and your own assumptions about, you know, the way things should work. And it's not that there isn't a way. There is a way to make things better, but you can't ever be less than vigilant about your own assumptions about where things are going. So we should probably pause.
Seems like you've stayed very vigilant for most of your career. Okay. Do you feel that your identity as a woman affected your career path and choices at all?
Yes, definitely.
In what ways?
Well, I think I think that I felt that relationships, you know, affectionate love relationships were really important, and they sometimes were as or more important than career. Mm. And I think that affected the way I looked at kind of my future. And I think that I think women tend to be, in their family relationships, more the caregivers, not just for children, but for mothers and fathers and siblings and friends and stuff like that. So some of that fell to me as well. And that affected some of the choices I made about career. And I think finally, one of the reasons why I ended up leaving Human Rights Watch was I had, at that point, I had kids. This was 2004. And I kind of came to a realization that, you know, even though I was very good at what I did, and there were other considerations as well, but the travel in Colombia was getting more and more, not more and more, but it was there was significant danger to the travel, mm-hmm. and I realized that if I wasn't able to come back from one of those trips, that my kids would not have a mother, mm-hmm. and I was the only mother they had, whereas there were a lot of different people who could be Human Rights Watch researchers, so I think that also affected the way I thought about, like, my appetite for risk changed. Mm-hmm.
And did you ever experience any discrimination in your career path as a woman?
Not like the overt, mm-hmm. sort of, you are female, therefore you get less and stuff. I think in some ways it worked in my favor. And this happens with some frequency with journalists in particular, or human rights advocates, or is that people underestimate you, or mm-hmm. they have certain preconceived notions about what you're capable of, and you can play with those and use mm-hmm. those to your advantage. So I think that was especially the case in a lot of the very male-centric environments in Latin America, where I'd be in with a bunch of generals, or, you know, be with the paramilitaries or something like that, and they would think, oh, she's not a problem, she's a girl, that kind of thing. But then I would be able to gather the information I needed and write it in the way I wanted and do with it what I needed to, and could be very effective and using a little bit of those prejudices in my favor.
Interesting. And you were talking about how September 11th was kind of a catalyst for you from moving to working in this very international human rights context to focusing more locally. Can you tell me more about that time for you?
Sure. I mean, I was already feeling a little constrained by the Human Rights Watch work I was doing, mainly because my supervisors didn't want me traveling as much in Colombia because of the dangers, and that was the part I liked the best. Mm-hmm. And so I was spending a lot more time in Washington, which I don't like, and not really getting that, you know, firsthand exposure that I really wanted. Mm-hmm. And it was particularly around a report that we did, which was my idea to do a report on child soldiers in Colombia. And it was given to someone else to actually research on the grounds that it would be too dangerous for me to go. And it was really hard to accept that. And so it started me thinking that maybe, you know, if I was going to be restricted in my travel, then for reasons that I didn't quite understand, and also because of the security situation, I was never able to speak publicly, or not never, but couldn't really speak publicly about the kind of work I was doing as an advocate. Mm-hmm. So it was always my boss, who was like this Chilean lawyer, a male, mm-hmm. who always got all the credit for all the work I did. And that maybe that's another place where, I mean, he did that with the men in the group too, so it wasn't just because I was a woman, but it just became uncomfortable not being able to travel, and then supposedly for security reasons not to be able to talk in public. And it was like, wait a second, if I'm not traveling, then I should be able to talk. But, mm-hmm. you know, so it was like, wait a second, maybe this is not the right thing. But I think the thing that really ended it for me was 9/11, was the attack on 9/11, mm-hmm. because for human rights, that was a huge blow. And for human rights in Latin America, that was a huge blow, because in the 1990s, the United States government became, in many ways, the best way to promote human rights. Mm-hmm. We really were in a different moment than we had been in the 80s or the 70s, where the U.S. was actively engaged in lots of human rights abuses in Chile or mm-hmm. Central America or wherever. But by the 1990s, human rights had become a key part of foreign policy for both Republicans and Democrats. Mm-hmm. So if you got the United States on board in some way in your human rights campaign, that was a huge plus. Mm-hmm. But after 9/11, that was all gone, because the United States became instead the main purveyor and even creator of new ways of violating human rights. So as an American traveling to Latin America, I felt, I don't know if this is actually true or not, but I felt that people were looking at me and saying, well, what the heck are you doing coming here, Colombia, Ecuador, mm-hmm. Haiti, wherever, to talk about human rights when your own country is pioneering all these new ways, you know, waterboarding, black sites, extraordinary rendition, drones, you know, all this is happening on your watch, not to mention immigration and the death penalty and continuing discrimination based on race or gender, whatever. All this stuff is going on in your own country, which doesn't even, you know, most of the your fellow Americans don't even understand what human rights are, let alone believe in them. You probably don't remember, but the immediately, like in the year or so after 9/11, if you tuned into any of these talk radio shows, the question wouldn't be should we torture? It would be how do we torture and how much? And so the for me, it was clear that as human rights advocates, we had spent spent more time on advocating human rights abroad than we had at home. And I felt like there was a real job for me at home to create a stronger, maybe more resilient culture of human rights, as there is in some parts of the world. I mean, that we have won human rights battles in lots of places where human rights is now a central part of the Constitution, a central part of the way people think. It doesn't mean that there are no bad things that happen, but it means that there's a resilience and a pushback when bad things happen in places like South Africa or Chile, or places that have gone through huge human rights issues, huge human rights moments. Argentina is another example where the governments and the people have a real understanding of why human rights is important, not just in a theoretical sense or in an abstract sense, but as a personal commitment and belief that human rights matter to me, to my family. And that just doesn't exist here still.
Do you think that that stems from kind of a very American exceptionalism notion that we're the best country in the world and we don't have any problems? And
I mean, I think that's a big part of it, that you know, human rights is for everyone else. You know, we have the Constitution. And other people haven't. I mean, I think this was a trope after 9/11 that we were. No one has been attacked like that before, and the fact that that is just complete bollocks is, you know, foreign to most Americans. You know, it's like lots of countries have gone through that or much, much worse. And a place I work now in Northern Ireland, it's just like. They have gone through, it may not have been the amount of people at that time, but it was over time just as or more destructive to their society, and they have figured out a different way of dealing with it. I think the UK in general is an interesting example because, you know, we had 9/11, and then it was, I think it was July 7th of 2007 that there were the bombings in London on the buses, and the English, not to say that everything they've done is perfect, but they very quickly used police work to round up the people responsible. They didn't torture them. They put them in front of courts, and they convicted them. And one of the reasons why we cannot convict the people behind 9/11 is because we tortured them. And those testimonies and that information is not admissible in our own courts because we tortured them. So, you know, we have convicted exactly no one for 9/11, whereas in other parts of the world they actually have proceeded in a way that's respectful of human rights, but actually have actually made the correct kind of gains in terms of law enforcement and getting the masterminds of these kinds of attacks, which is important. I'm not at all saying that it's not important to do that, but you have to do it in the right way.
And kind of switching gears a little bit, was this also around the time that you were focusing on founding the Duke Human Rights Center?
That's kind of what my transition was like. If I'm not going to be with Human Rights Watch and I want to keep writing and I want to keep working on human rights, how do I do that? And that was a real puzzle for me at that time. And so with colleagues here, people I knew through for personal reasons or just because I lived here, we began to talk. Well, why doesn't talk about that question? Why doesn't Duke have human rights something, you know, a something in human rights? And could Duke really do something interesting in human rights where Duke would add something new to the mix, which would be looking at human rights locally as well as internationally, human rights at home, looking at the legacy of the civil rights movement, looking at the legacy of slavery and segregation, and really see the human rights story in the context of civil rights movement. And how can we really deeply engage with students and practitioners and say, this isn't just some sort of critique that we're going to do of human rights, or this isn't just the practice of human rights. Mm-hmm. Let's have a melding of the two where we have people talking, you know, legitimately about some of the problems with human rights, some of the limitations, some of the faulty assumptions within human rights, but then also, well, if we've got human rights and it's working in some ways, you know, how can we make it work better? And that became kind of the seed of the Duke Human Rights Center.
And tell me more about your website, Talking Rights. Was that also established around the same time?
Gosh, that's a good question. I think probably around the same time. And it was a way for me to force myself also to begin, you know, to keep writing on human rights issues without the platform of Human Rights Watch. And, as a writer, it's, you know, you have all these different registers in a way that you can look at for writing. And the real question is, for the public you want to reach, which is the correct register. And for human rights, it's often the report, which no one will read but the policymakers, or maybe the governments, or maybe the people involved will read. But it's a tool. It's a lobbying tool. So you say, you know, all the information is right here. I've gathered it. I've analyzed it. I've put it in a coherent format, and I've made an argument. And I've also, which is the essential thing, it's often hard for students to get to this point, I've also really thought about it deeply enough so I know the direction that should be pursued to try to correct this wrong. That's really hard for students to get to that point, to say, I really know about the situation, and this is what needs to be done to correct it. And that's kind of the Human Rights Watch report. But I wrote two books along with, when I was at Human Rights Watch, I also wrote two books, one of which came out, of course, like the month after 9/11, something like that, of all the stuff that didn't fit into the Human Rights Watch reports, like my own personal experiences in both Peru and Colombia, and some of the vagaries of human rights, and some of the difficulties, and some of the questions, and some of the personal accounts of the people I met, and all that went into my nonfiction books. And so that was another register. It's like, how can I make the argument to the American... The reason behind those books was, how can I make the argument to the American people that they should care about these countries, far, far away countries? Peru, it's like Incas, you know, Machu Picchu. What do we know about Peru? And it has an amazing history. And at that time, when my book on Peru was published, it also had an amazing connection to the United States, because that's where most of the coca that's converted into cocaine comes from. And then my book on Colombia was, once that coca economy had switched to Colombia, then all of a sudden Colombia becomes the focus of the drug war. And so my book was also a way of saying to Americans, look, know more about this country that's supplying you with all the cocaine that you're buying, because you, as American consumers, are fueling this conflict in a way that's much, that overshadows any sort of U.S. military aid to Colombia. Because, you know, lefties will always say, oh, stop U.S. military aid. And it's like, U.S. military aid is a penny compared with a $100 bill of cocaine profits. You know, sure, you can do something about military aid, you know, the million or billion dollars or whatever that goes into military aid. It has no effect whatsoever on the $46 billion every year that we're sending into Colombia as consumers. And as a human rights person, I have to care about that $1 billion in military aid, but I also have to care about that $46 billion in cash. And it's, in some ways, it's sort of similar to the way we talk about Apple now and their factories in China. It's like, we can scream until we're blue in the face about China, but as long as we keep buying those products that are built in factories where people are dying or where people are being poisoned, that is not going to stop. So if we care about human rights, we have to care not only as politicians or as voters, but we have to also care as consumers. So.
And how do you get so deeply inside these issues? What is your research process like?
Talking to people. And then reading everything that you possibly can. Journalism, books, papers, interviews. I mean, you just immerse yourself in these histories. And with a great deal of humility, because you're never going to be able to understand. I had one review come out in Colombia of the book I wrote on Colombia after the book had been translated into Spanish. And it was in one of the major newspapers, and the guy had written a column on my book, and he hated it. And I was reading what he'd written, and he'd quoted a lot from the book, and he'd quoted all the best parts. I mean, just as a writer, sometimes you're like, yes, you know, it's not the flowery language; it's when you really, really nail it. in some way. You just really nail it, and you know it. You know it when that happens. And he picked out all these best parts where I really nailed it. And then I realized that his real problem was that he was reading this book as a Colombian. I'd written the book for Americans. And he didn't like the way Colombia was portrayed to Americans. He really didn't agree. And he was saying, well, we have this great history. We have this deep intellectual tradition. You know, we have all that. She never mentioned anything about this or this or this. And it's like, yeah, I didn't mention. And I didn't mention everything about the intellectual tradition because in the States, nobody cares. You know, that's not. The book wasn't written for you. It was written for somebody who cares nothing about Colombia, and it was written as a way of reaching Americans and trying to convince them to care. So you know, I think often students, especially, they realize that there's something they want to write, and so, but they don't really connect that question to who do you want to reach. And that's really important as a writer. And for me, it was always really important to use these different registers, you know, the human rights report, the op-ed, the nonfiction book, the fiction, the poetry, the essays, the scripts, the whatever, you know, and not see writing as just like a one-track thing, but really dependent on who is it that we want to reach and how.
And I find it interesting that you recently returned to school to pursue a Master's of Fine Arts in Creative Writing at Vermont University. So kind of continuing with this theme of reaching your audience, do you think creative writing offers a different lens for understanding human rights than previous styles that you were working with that were more academic or reporting style?
Yeah, I don't think it's a value like better or worse. It's just different. But when my daughter especially was getting into middle school, she was starting to read all these great books, and I'd always written fiction, not necessarily successfully, but I'd always written it. And I started to read the books that she recommended to me. And I think I mentioned the last time the one book in particular was The Book Thief, which is, if you haven't read it, go read it.
I will.
In fact, I might bring it tomorrow and leave it for you.
Thank you.
It is like a, you know, blow the top off your head kind of a book. And it's about the Holocaust, but it's unlike any book you've ever read about the Holocaust. And it's written, it wasn't necessarily, I don't know if he really didn't write it for kids, but it ended up being young adult stuff is a marketing thing as more than anything else. It's not very few people successfully say, I am going to write for a teenager. You know, they end up writing for you know, more towards young people. But there's this whole area now of crossover books where books might be appropriate for young adults, but they're also being read by adults. As, I don't know if you watch Colbert at all, but there was a great interview that he did last week with John Green. Do you know who John Green is?
But I'm reading The Fall.
Okay, I'm not going to tell you anything about it. It's a great book.
I love him.
Yeah, and he's great. And so Colbert says, and of course Colbert is incredibly smart, and he says, so Mr. Green, the definition of a YA book is a book people want to read, correct? And it's like, yes, yes, actually. Because books for young people are not boring. They have plots and characters and fun things happening. And, you know, you see all these adults on the airplane, you know, hiding the fact that they're reading Harry Potter. You know, it's just like, but it's not necessarily the greatest. I would argue The Book Thief is great literature, but, you know, Harry Potter is a great deal of fun. But Harry Potter also gets into all sorts of really interesting questions about how you live your life and what about your parents and this and that. So anyway, long story. So I set out to see if some of the human rights ideas I have could translate into works that would be accessible to young people, but also accessible to old people, but that would be really in a compelling story. And one of the things that I really wanted to write about was the issue of genocide. Are we okay on time?
We are.
Because I think often, I just had coffee with a writer friend, and I was telling her a little bit about the book I'm working on now. And I said something like, I was really happy to discover, in the way writers do, you write about something, you don't really know what it's about until you've kind of percolated it through your mind, and then all of a sudden you realize, that's what that's about. That's what's going on there. And I'd had this moment with this book where I realized this character, a young woman, who's writing this list,
I was like, what is she doing there? What is she doing there? Why is she there? And I realized that she's Adolf Eichmann. She's making the list for people to be taken away to the concentration camp. And it's like, that's what she's there for. And I ran out of my office. I'm jumping up and down like a lunatic in my backyard saying, she's Adolf Eichmann. She's Adolf Eichmann. Woo, 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 woo. And my friend, who's a writer, said, oh, you mean she's evil? And I said, no, she's not evil. She's just doing her job. That's what she was supposed to do. And so she did her job. That it resulted in genocide? Yes, that's also true. But I think too often people think the people responsible for human rights abuses, the people responsible for genocide, are evil. Mm-hmm. And that's wrong. Oh. They're often good people. And I think the engine of genocide, as far as I've been able to see, and looking at Rwanda, Cambodia, Germany during the Holocaust, Armenia, the Turks in Armenia, genocide is almost always done by, for moral reasons. In fact, Claudia Kuntz, mm-hmm. who's a professor, she's over, I was just talking to her just now when you came over. She wrote a book called The Nazi Conscience, which is an incredible book. And the first line of that book is, the title of this book is not an oxymoron. The Nazis had a morality. And that morality was, the Jews are bad. And the Jews are poisoning us, and the Jews are taking all our money, and the Jews are manipulating everyone's politics, not just ours in Germany, but the world. So guess what? It's a tough job, it's a dirty job, but we're going to do it. We will get rid of them for you. And we're taking the fall, but you know we're the ones to do it, and we will then cleanse the world of this terrible threat. And it's the same rationale in Rwanda, it's the same rationale in Cambodia, where the people who commit the genocide are claiming Serbia, whatever, they're claiming they're doing it for all the right reasons. And that's what I wanted to get at in a book. It's like, how does that work? How do people become convinced that this horrible thing that they're doing is the right and moral thing? And then the next question is then, how does someone in that universe realize that that thing is wrong and that that thing needs to be stopped? And you could say the same thing for U.S. history, slavery. I mean, slavery used to be the oil that ran our economy. How was it that these crazy Quakers and these crazy Englishmen and these crazy abolitionists in the United States, how is it that they finally looked at this thing and said, we are going to stop it? You know, the largest civil disobedience ever in the United States, ever, was the Underground Railroad. But it's never taught that way. It's just taught as like Harriet Tubman and Sojourner Truth and, you know, these good people were, but, you know, to do that, to take people out of the South at that time, slaves, property, expensive property, and to put your own life and your own treasure and your own family at risk, that's a tremendous decision. That is hard to do. So the book, my books and the fiction that I'm writing now is kind of trying to get at that, like from a character perspective. What is it like to be that person? What does that person look at and see? And how does that person come to the realization that the society that they're in is doing some terrible thing? And I think young people are really interested in that. You know, young people are great readers. And you don't pander to them. You can be really smart with them. And I think books like The Book Thief or the His Dark Materials series, the Golden Compass series, I don't know if you've read that, but that's a huge attack on the church. I love it. But that's just like frontal on the church and the whole idea of organized religion. And there's a whole list of these books that really are much more political in some ways and much more engaged than a lot of the, you know, writing for adults. And I think it's exciting to write for kids who really care about these issues, and but who are kind of fed in their classes and stuff this very simplistic view of the world, like good and evil, you know, the bad Nazis, the good, you know, the good allies and stuff like that. And it's like some of the worst, you know, the worst atrocities in World War II were committed by the Allies, you know, at the end of the war, you know, the firebombing of Dresden. I mean, but it's just like, those people are good, those people are evil, and I want to complicate that. And one of the great ways to do that is through fiction.
Wow. That is amazing insight. And it seems that you have continued your commitment to inspiring young people with the expansions you've implemented at Duke around human rights. So could you speak a little bit more about why it's important to you to engage students at Duke with human rights issues, both locally and in international contexts?
Well, because I think they're the ones that get the world after I'm gone. And it's like you want to offer interested students like a framework for understanding themselves, understanding the world. They may not end up becoming, you know, crusaders, but if they become engaged citizens, if they become people who really deeply care about the world and what goes on in it, both the world at home and the world abroad, I think that's all good. And, you know, it's sometimes can be very frustrating in just because it's hard to kind of break through and I'm sure I had it as well. It's not just this generation, but there's almost a sense among some students that, you know, the world as we have it is just fine. You know, there are mm-hmm. some things you can do on the edges, but, you know, basically things are going to keep going the way they're going, and that no substantive change can ever really happen. Mm-hmm. And the fact is that substantive change happens all the time. And it just takes some imagination and some sight, you know, be able to see it. I mean, the example of gay marriage is one of the most spectacular. No one, and not even the most dedicated gay rights activists or the most dedicated opponents of gay rights, foresaw that we as a culture in the United States would shift so dramatically and at such speed in these last 10 years. No one foresaw this. But in fact, there's been a huge change, And that was unforeseen. I mean, the change in South Africa is also something remarkable, that there could have been a shift from apartheid to democracy, albeit with all its problems, but a shift from essentially, you know, one of the most abusive states in history to a democracy. That's spectacular. Mm-hmm. That prosperity could be coming to Latin America and places like Chile and Argentina or Brazil. Mm-hmm. We're talking a lot about Brazil now because of the World Cup, but one of the, you know, hidden stories of Brazil is a robust and growing middle class. Mm-hmm. Under a socialist government, mm-hmm. which has fostered prosperity and has mm-hmm. fostered healthcare and has fostered education and has fostered better housing, in a country that used to be, notorious for all sorts of human rights abuses, including the most mundane, meaning lack of housing, lack of food, lack of education. So I think I want students not to be so kind of stunned by the internet and Facebook and Twitter and Snapchat mm-hmm. and Hoosay and whatever else is out today. Mm-hmm. My son was just showing me something the other day, and it was just like, oh my God. But, you know, just being stuck to, you know, you've been in the airport recently, and it's kind of frightening to see mm-hmm. everyone stuck to their devices. And mm-hmm. it's like, yes, there's all sorts of great stuff that they bring to us, but they also can distract us from looking at each other. And I want students to see, yes, you can have your device, but you can also be, you know, passionately engaged in the world and whatever floats your boat, but to be engaged and to care is what the kind of things I want students to take out of any sort of classes I do, to really passionately care about the world and do something to make it better.
And you spoke a little bit earlier about the limits of kind of do-gooderism. Mm-hmm. How do you see that philosophy being passed on to your students? Or how do you see people understanding human rights differently over time in your experience?
When I start teaching a class on human rights, I always hand out this little index card and ask people to write down what they think human rights are. And the fact is that there's pretty much no wrong answer. Because the Universal Declaration is long and complicated mm-hmm. and has all sorts of gray areas that can be interpreted. You know, for instance, there's a whole clause on the right to marry, and at the time in 1948, they would never have interpreted that as a right to marry same sex, but mm-hmm. it says nothing about gender in mm-hmm. that clause. So gay marriage is okay by the Universal mm-hmm. Declaration. Woohoo! Not that that carries an argument, but I think, remind me the question again. I was going to go off on a tangent.
How do you see students or just people in general understanding
kind of over
human
time.
Rights
yeah.
differently over time,
well, I
approaching
think,
it differently.
You know, I think I'll use as an example the program I have in Northern Ireland for Duke Engage. I think people come to Northern Ireland just sort of like, what is your problem, you people? You've been fighting since 1300. Mm. Give it a rest. You know, find a different way to be. You know, find a way to move on. And they're always shocked when the Northern Irish come right back at them and say, so how's that working for you? Because we have the same problem. They see difference in terms of tribe, the Catholic tribe and the Protestant tribe. It's nothing to do with religion. It's mm-hmm. all about tribalism. Mm. We see difference in race. It is equally irrelevant in terms of what really is the person. Mm-hmm. But we will make distinctions based on race. And we have exactly the same problems that they have in Northern Ireland. But I think one of the things is we don't want to talk about it. Whereas in Northern mm-hmm. Ireland, people won't stop talking about it. And it's mm-hmm. amazing how people frontally... And that's why the Pauli Murray Project is so great. Because it's mm-hmm. like the Pauli Murray Project takes that thing and says, let's talk about these difficult mm-hmm. truths. Let's talk about the fact that we're not, you know, mm-hmm. integrated. We're not all getting along. Equality mm-hmm. is not mm-hmm. applicable to everyone in the same way. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the thing I want students to do is to look at themselves and to see their own privilege and their own mm-hmm. histories and their own, the way they've been shaped by their families, mm-hmm. their, you know, poor or rich, mm-hmm. middle class or, you know, striving, black, white, brown, red, yellow, whatever, but that they see themselves and see, and but that doesn't stop them. Because, you know, the richest, whitest kid from the most privileged background has something to give us. But that kid can't do that without a deep self-examination of their own privilege. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really hard for a lot of Duke students. Mm-hmm. You know, I think Duke students in general are getting more complicated. I think it's different at UNC, where UNC has always been a bigger catch-all. It's a bigger school, mm-hmm. but also there's a lot more poor kids there. There's mm-hmm. a lot more racial diversity. Mm-hmm. There are a lot more perspectives at UNC than there mm-hmm. are at Duke. Duke still tends to be relatively privileged. I mean, you ask any group of Duke students who went to private school and three-quarters mm-hmm. of them will raise their hands. And, you know, mm-hmm. have you ever been out of the country and, like, 14 of them will say, you know, France, England, you know. Mm-hmm. They're incredibly privileged. Mm-hmm. And then they think, it sometimes is the case, they think that's meaningless. It's like, oh, yeah, but... You know, I worked hard for what I had. It's like, no. You have to actually look at that and say, we all have things that went on in our lives that made mm-hmm. us, put us ahead or put us behind. Mm-hmm. And it's not that one thing or the other thing makes it impossible for you to be an actor mm-hmm. in your own life, but you have to cop to it. You have mm-hmm. to understand it and then work with it mm-hmm. in order to reach out to people mm-hmm. and actually make a positive change. Mm-hmm. And I think that's, humility is one thing that Duke students have to learn, mm-hmm. students in general. Mm-hmm. And also just, you know, learn history mm-hmm. and respect for other people and all that kind of stuff is surprisingly difficult sometimes for students to grasp. Mm-hmm.
It sounds like to me that a lot of your work is focused on trying to get people to see, to face their truths mm-hmm. In order to heal the wounds of the past, mm-hmm. which is something that Pauli Murray, a reoccurring right. theme in her legacy. Mm-hmm. How do you think your approach compares to her vision of justice?
I mean, I'm in awe of her. I'm nowhere near her in terms of being able to be mm-hmm. as dedicated and as relentless as her. Mm-hmm. And I think, at the same time, I think that her example is huge for me because I think the one thing that, especially as you get older, I think the one thing you really end up being able to do, which maybe you can't, or few people are able to do when they're younger, is to be yourself, as weird mm-hmm. as that sounds. Because if you're younger and you're trying to be in a career, or you're trying to impress people, like, I can do this, mm-hmm. you know, you're always kind of putting these fronts up of, you know, competence or intelligence or I'll work harder than anyone, and you're kind of trying on identities, and it's also part of being young. You're just trying on these different identities, and as you get older, you're like, finally say, you know what? I am who I am. Who said that? Pogo said that. But, you know, I am who I am, and I, you know, the good and the bad, it's all right here. And I think Pauli Murray was sort of relentless in insisting in that whole person. Mm-hmm. And not being divisible into, mm-hmm. and for her it was very personal, but also very political. Not being mm-hmm. the female, the lawyer, the black person, the gay person, mm-hmm. You know, the daughter, the niece, that she was always the writer, the academic, the priest, the lawyer. She insisted on being the whole person and having all of that contribute to everything she did. That is really hard mm-hmm. to do. And that's something that I kind of still aspire to. But it's like I would never have spoken to anyone about the young adult writing I do because it's not, you know, considered, especially in an academic environment, it's not considered, like, worthy. It's not considered important. And it's like, well, actually, it is important. And I believe it's important. So I'm going to talk about it. And I'm going to be that person who's writing YA, even if people don't appreciate or respect it. It's like, I'm done with that. And, you know, the human rights stuff, if you don't agree with my human rights stuff, that's fine. But I'm going to keep doing it. And I'm going to keep being a feminist, and I'm going to keep being a mom, and I'm going to keep being a Rottweiler walker, and I'm going to keep watching The Wire, and God damn it, if you want to come watch The Walking Dead with me, I would love it. I love that show. It's like, I'm out there, you know, at this point. It's like, done with trying to hide these little pieces of the thing that I think, well, maybe people won't really respect that, and maybe that's not, you know, that's not what a, you know, a successful professional woman should be doing. And it's like, done. And I think Pauli Murray was so visionary and so resolute in doing that. That's something that I aspire to still.
Well, it seems like not only do you not want people to simplify human rights issues, but you also don't want them to simplify people, including yourself and who you are and your work, which I think is very connected to Pauli Murray. And I want to be mindful of your time. And I think we're about out of time.
Okay.
But
I just have to meet somebody.
If there's any final thoughts or reflections or any stories you have left that you want to share?
I mean, I think the only thing I would say, and this kind of unifies everything in a way of the stuff that I do, is and Pauli Murray, is the importance of stories. And I think that is something that, you know, often people lament, you know, the fact that people don't read anymore, or people are separate, you know, people, you know, are there with their machines and not interacting with each other, not being part of a community. And I think that one of the other things that Pauli Murray shows us, and one of the other things I think is so important about the Pauli Murray Project, is the fact that stories will never be out of date for us. They'll never be useless. We are in an age of more stories than ever. And they can be personal stories, they can be true stories, they can be memoirs, they can be the stories we tell each other as members of a community, the stories we hear. You know, as important as telling stories is hearing other people's stories and deeply engaging with those stories. But, you know, stories like the ones I'm writing that for fiction, or stories that you get in the movies, or stories that you get in plays, people are, you know, I don't know if you've ever been to a story slam, but go to the Monty, which is the, you know, the real story event that they have in Durham, or if you listen to the Moth podcast, people are more than ever thirsty and hungry for stories, because it helps us understand who we are, where we've been, and where we're going. And I think the huge part of her legacy that I would also like to just mention, along with her insistence on being a whole person, is her insistence on telling her own story, and the hard parts as well, in a loving, human way, and reaching out. You know, it's not easy to tell a sad story about yourself, or a story that makes you look weak. And I know it was always hard for her own sexuality. It was like, how did that play in her public persona? And her own, you know, she failed sometimes. So it's not that her life is not easy at all. Sometimes you just get exhausted thinking about everything that she did and how tireless she was and how much she moved. And, oh, my God, her life was not easy. But she insisted on that, being that whole person, and she insisted in various ways on that importance of the story. And that's, as a writer, that's another thing I take from her and say, this is something that inspires me.
Wow. Well, thank you very much.
Good. Thank you for doing this.